Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. Reverend Graylin Hagler, pastor at Washington, D.C.'s Plymouth Congregational Church, is an activist and advocate for racial justice. He was a guest earlier this month for a conversation with the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. And after the recent death of George Floyd, he spoke with the center via Zoom about systemic racism and police brutality. We'll hear from Reverend Hagler in a few moments, and he will be introduced by Michael Spath. Thank you for listening, and a quick note, this program includes descriptions of racial violence. You may want to listen another time if you have kids in the room.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Dr. Michael Spath, and I'm the Executive Director of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace, based in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're the Indiana voice for peace, justice, human rights, an intercultural encounter. For over five decades, Graylin Hagler has been on the front lines in Chicago, Boston, and Washington, D.C., and continues his advocacy for political, economic, and racial justice. He has protested injustices against Blacks and Latinos, confronted corporations on hiring practices, and challenged local governments' systemic injustices, including as an outspoken critic of military tactics used by police. He has marched, organized coalitions, been arrested, all the while continuing as a voice of nonviolent resistance. He's been a tireless partner in the struggle for full Palestinian political and human rights too. Graylin is senior pastor at Plymouth Congregational Church, United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. co-leader of the Poor People's Campaign. So it's timely and important that we speak today with our friend, Pastor Graylin Hagler. Hagler, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Let's get right to it, Graylin. For those of us around the country, while we remain drawn to Minneapolis, and all that's happening there. In fact, the memorial service for George Floyd is happening as we speak. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But we've also been following what's been happening in our nation's capital. So why don't you update us about what's been, about the latest in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there's been actions pretty much every day. We've under 11 p.m. curfew last night. But the previous two nights, we were on a 7 p.m. curfew as they tried to, quote unquote, clamp down on the protesters and the demonstration. One of the important things is that on, as you know, because everybody saw it on Monday, protesters were attacked by military police, and they were pepper bombed and rubber bullets and pushed out of the way with shields so that the guy in the White House could walk across Lafayette Park and stand in front of the Episcopal Church there on the corner across from the park and hold up his Bible had nothing to say, but held up his Bible as a symbolic tactic to continue to try to fan the flames of his base. So there's been demonstrations, and one thing that was I thought was great, the next day, which would have been Tuesday, the crowd really quadrupled outside of Lafayette Park in response to the tactic that happened the previous day. And so they were stretched all the way back down 16th Street and all around. And one of the things that the president has been engaged in is trying to enlarge the perimeter of protection, which only demonstrates that that they're really afraid of the public, really afraid of these voices. I don't know if they expected for the reaction to be as strong as it has been, but one of the things that is clear is that they cannot put this genie back in the bottle because people are really sick and tired. And also, I think the thing that really got to folks was to be able to graphically look at video as somebody dies in front of your eyes all over the country and all over the world. Because I've received notices that people have been marching in Amsterdam, and people have been marching in the UK, and people have been marching all over Palestinians have stood up in solidarity with what was going, what is going on in this country, because people recognize what it looks like when folks attempt to oppress, when folks do oppress, the kind of characteristics that they carry on. It's a fascism. And I think clearly in the United States, we can realize just how fragile this thing we have called a democracy is.
I've also seen the picture, and it's still continuing, I believe. And think of the symbol of this, troops lining the steps of the Lincoln Memorial as they overlook protesters in D.C. I mean, I'm not ignorant of Lincoln's mixed legacy, during the Civil War. But isn't it mind-boggling to find troops guarding the Lincoln Memorial from people participating in nonviolent demonstrations, protesting the killing of an unarmed black man? I mean, it's mind-boggling, really.
Well, they understand that that's symbolically, that's where the 1963 march took place, where King spoke. So they understand the symbolism of that, understand the symbolism of what it means if everyday people take over that monument and is able to organize and speak from that monument. So they're closing down, trying to close down all those symbols from the people.
You've been involved in protests and demonstrations your entire adult life. And you build broad coalitions between people of different faiths and also just people of goodwill of no particular religious faith. And yet you are a Christian pastor. I want you to say a word about the optics and just the use and abuse of the president's use of the Bible as a prop in the church, St. John's Church, as a prop on Monday night. You referred to it, but say a little bit more about that.
Well, I'm gonna come at it this way, that very seldom do we talk about that there is no one Christian movement. There are Christian movements that have been filled with hatred and the justification of enslavement, the justification of settler colonialism, the justification of the extermination of Native people on this soil and in South America and all over the Caribbean, the depopulation of Africa sanctioned by a certain kind of Christianity that is really empire Christianity. It does nothing but love power. It is very macho and very masculine in its nature, and it is very fundamentalist, and it enforces a status quo kind of value system. On the other hand, there's a faith movement that has always been a resistance to the status quo. It's already always been a faithful resistance to empire religion. And so when he walked out there and held up his Bible in front of the church, it was a statement to that empire religion, that we're still together. We're gonna fight to hold on to this thing. We're gonna fight to return me to office, because we know that's what he's talking about. But he held up that Bible in which to solidify that very racist base, that Klan originating base. Somebody might get upset with that, but that's really the nature of religion. We've always had a religion that preached, slaves be obedient to your masters. We always had a religion that preached that secular authority has been appointed by God. And I hear people all the time, particularly that Mr. Pillow guy, saying that this man in the White House has been elected and ordained by God. And I'm putting that out there because you got one of them pillars, burn it. Got one of those pillars, throw them out of your house, right? Don't buy one. And that's a part of the sort of the struggle that we're engaged in. When they talk about cultural wars, it's not culture, it's ideology. It's an ideological war. It's a war of theology. It's a war in order for those of us who believe in inclusion and those of us who believe in hearing one another and respecting one another versus those who want to control the world and bend the world towards their own ideology and their own understanding and their own greed, because it's not just bending it to their ideology. It's also bending the world into a kind of paradigm where they can steal everything they want, including lands and culture and resources. So that's the battle. So he stood up there and basically tapped into his ideological base, which we have to struggle against and deal with.
Brother Cornel West talks about, calls the president a neo-fascist gangster. So you were, you were gentle compared to Brother Cornel. Hey, let's return now to the reason why the people are out in the streets. And I want you to say a word about George Floyd. Already in the 1980s, you were an outspoken critic of, and earlier than that, Chicago's and Boston's police departments, gang control tactics, involving the searching of young black men on the streets without a warrant or probable cause. You became vice president of the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union. Now we add the names of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd to an ever-growing list. I mean, it's an ever-growing list, right, of African-American men and women who've been killed sleeping while black, jogging while black, shopping while black. Talk to us about the systemic racism and rage that really this latest murder really of George Floyd, where it's caught on video camera, that's sweeping the country.
And that's the issue. These are the names we know. There are thousands of names that we don't know.
Yeah.
There are folks exactly who got away with the victimization and the murder of people. When I arrived in Boston in 1981, I was there a few months before I ended up being locked up and charged with about 15 charges, one including attempted murder, and of a police officer, I might add. And I was on trial for the next year and a half. And one of the things that got me was that after I originally got out of jail, got bailed out, I'm home and I turn on TV and I watching the news, and the district attorney goes on the air live and says that we have a very dangerous person, an outside agitator who's pretending to be clergy, and we're gonna get 45 years in max security prison on him. He was referring to me. And so that when the fight was on and I realized that they were serious. And what was going on was that we were doing a lot of racial justice organizing then, in the midst of illegal police searches, in the midst of whites really just patrolling the streets of Boston and jumping on black families and beating black couples and beating black individuals, and nobody ever going to jail, nobody ever being locked up for that. And so we started opposing it, we started organizing around it, and that was their message back to me, was we're gonna show you how we can handle you. Well, you know, God is always a great God, because they didn't handle me too well. And I ended up walking out of that courtroom, like I said, a year and a half later, totally exonerated. But you know, it's those types of things, because I could have easily been in max security prison. Guy, when I was doing prison ministry in Walpole, which is max security prison, just called me like a month ago. And he called me to tell me this. He says, Rev, he says, there's not a day that has gone by that I've not thought about you, and you're the first call I'm making. I'm out. He had been in for 45 years.
Oh, my.
45 years for something that he did not do. And when he finally was able, 45 years later, to get a new trial, the evidence that was there wasn't there. And it also came out that they had trumped up testimony against him to put him away. And so I'm raising all this because that's how it takes place. So, you know, in the NAACP years ago, 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, used to hang a flag out of their headquarters that say, yesterday a man was lynched, in response to the lynchings that were taking place all around the country, to remind people that people were actually being lynched, not in the paper anywhere, not recorded anywhere. Folks didn't have telephone cameras, all those types of things. I mean, so things took place in such a way to try to, in a sense, intimidate and keep black folks in their place. I was just looking through a newspaper article and an old newspaper article, Pulse, and it was so interesting, the attitude, and it shows you the attitude. Oscar DePreece gets elected on the south side of Chicago to Congress, and he gets elected because of really the migration from the south into places like Chicago that created a very large black community. And so he's the first one, pretty much the first one since Reconstruction to be returned to Congress. And the president's wife or something invited the wives of Congress people to the White House for luncheon. And of course, Oscar DePreece's wife was in that crowd, which I don't think the president's first lady realized it, but invited her, and she went. And there was a senator from South Carolina that was quoted in the Washington Post that now we got to lynch 1,000 of them to put them back in their place. That's the mentality. And so what I'm getting at is that it's only being caught on camera now. It's only coming to light right now. But this is the stuff that black folks have been dealing with historically. You know, it's, as somebody said, you know, we're not only got to hold our breath from the pandemic. We got to hold our breath around cops. We got to hold our breath around all kinds of institutionalized racism. We got to hold our breath around white supremacy, and we got to hold our breath now more than ever. And so finally, we particularly got young folks who are breathing, who are showing us all how to breathe, showing us all how to walk across this country, move across this country, wake up this country, and try to deliver something of worth to this country. Because we've been playing games around racism and white supremacy for years.
I want to ask you about the pandemic in a minute, but I want to return to what you said just a few minutes ago. You know, just as you said that there are many Christianities present within Christian history, some that have been life-affirming, many that have been life-negating. Likewise, there have been different Americas. And the America that we're seeing now with Black Hawk helicopters deployed in the nation's capital and armed military supplementing local police. This vision of America, these competing visions of America have dominated our discourse in the last number of years, but particularly under this president.
Well, this president is upfront with it. That's the only difference, because it has been here just about with every other president that you've had, who've had no courage with which to take on white supremacy or dismantle the policies of race and racism, or even challenge this ideological perspective. And it's not only just the ideological perspective that's dangerous on the right, but a lot of white folks who consider themselves in the middle are filled with just as much racism and bias and prejudice as possible, misconceptions about black folks and people of color. And one of the things that I always point out is that if you're black or you're Latino, you generally have to go into a white community to work, to survive. So you have to learn how to speak their language a little bit. You have to learn the sensibilities of their culture a little bit. You have to work in close proximity to them. It doesn't happen the other way around. White folks very seldom come into black or Latino communities and have to walk around them and learn to speak the language and learn about the cultural sensitivity. And so what happens is that all around us, there is a continual diet of white supremacist ideology. Just turn on your TV any particular night. Look at any TV show. The stereotypes are there. The stereotypes are there, and the good cop is there. The stereotypes are there, and the anti-terrorism is there. So in a sense, you know, we've gotten very militarized in our own thinking, cultural, and enculturated with what is presented to us through mass media. And we're never very critical about it. We don't think about what we're actually being fed a diet.
Yeah. Let's say a word. You mentioned the... we're going to come back to talking about the issues of racial justice. In fact, maybe they're interrelated here. While we've been talking about, you know, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, we're still dealing with the COVID pandemic, with more than 107,000 dead in our country, which the president now is more than willing to ignore. You've been an advocate for racial justice, for workers' rights your entire life. One of the things that's offended me the most is the way those on the political and the religious right account that some lives are worth more than others so we can reopen the country. In other words, some lives are more expendable. And I guess I want to ask you, how has the pandemic, this is poor people's campaign language now, how has the pandemic exposed the fissures that were already present in American society, but actually exposed them as even greater than we once thought?
Well, I can talk from a very personal experience because I've had about 20 funerals since this pandemic started. It has been members who were exposed because they were in the kinds of jobs that they could not work remotely. Everybody wants to talk about underlying conditions, and yeah, that's somewhat true. But, you know, when you start talking about a lot of poor communities, immigrant communities, you find you got folks who are working in convalescent homes, nursing homes, and they are not able to do social distancing. One young man die. This young man, he was in his 50s, immigrant from the Cameroon. And we've been fighting that he could be able to stay in the United States because they had issued his deportation orders more than once, only to die now because the job he had was a job that he was there in the midst without protection and nobody seemed to care. So I've had funeral after funeral of people who've been exposed and older folks who've been exposed and have died. You know, one of the things is that in Washington, D.C., the city is broken down into wards. And one of the quote unquote affluent wards tends to be Ward 4, or at least everybody thinks so. Ward 4 is also a very heavily black ward, and it's also a very heavily elderly ward. And what they found out in this pandemic, that in this so-called affluent ward, it has led the city in contagion and comes only second to the poorest ward in the city. So it just continues to demonstrate to you that you talk about racial disparity, and you talk about racial disparity in terms of who has contracted the virus and who has died from the virus. And it's very clear to me that this is not a hypothetical thing, and it's not something that I need to sort of create theories and hypotheses around because I've been too busy burying folks.
Tell us a little bit more about your ministry, especially in this with the funerals and the ministry to the families in this time of pandemic.
Well, it's rough, particularly at the beginning, because families were not able to be present with their loved ones as their loved ones made their transition. If the medical staff wasn't too busy, somebody. May have taken the opportunity, and in a couple instances they did, to do a FaceTime with the family members as the person passed on. But by and large, most of these people who passed on alone, and family members had to have funerals for them, and some of them didn't have funerals for them. Some of them just cremated because there was no place to go. The funeral homes were backed up with bodies, and so that could not be scheduled at all. I've done a few funerals at the church where we live streamed it so that people could actually see the service and participate in it in that way. But it's very difficult because you got families who have a real loss and don't necessarily have a sense of closure.
Speaking about your ministry, Graylin, have you ever had to have the talk with any of your young members?
Yeah.
You want to say a word about that?
Well, I mean, and it's something that's actively being discussed and has been discussed. Particularly my young men sit down, because we'll always have a few of them who get in trouble. A lot of them, most of them got in trouble undeservedly, I might point out, just picked up on the street corner, singled out for some whatever reason by the police. And next thing they know, they got some type of charge against them, which always then triggers the discussion that you're going to have with a larger group to try to get folks to understand what just happened, how they can avoid it, how they can basically protect themselves in a very hostile world. I was mistaken. I was remembering a story in my parents. I was born and raised in Baltimore. My parents bought a store after the 68 riots. And it was the store that that we had a credit in. They called it the book. You know, you put it in the book until payday, then you come back and you pay off the bill. It was after the riots that people decided to leave the city in this mass exodus, and my parents bought that store on the corner. And it was a few years into that that my father decided that he was going to go out and buy a Lincoln Continental. And you got to remember, up until that point, we had used Fords and used Plymouths and stuff that they got off some used car lot somewhere. So he went out and bought it. That was his first new car. So we all went out, obviously, to pick it up. So we drive it off the lot. I don't think we've gone six blocks. Police pulls us over and says, routine check. And that's what they used to do to black folks in Baltimore, was that they see you in a car, it was routine check, because it was to harass you all along the way. And so, you know, and so it's clear that we got to talk to our young folks, because that was just raw then, but now it takes place in terms of jump outs, what's called jump outs in DC. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
I'm not. Please explain it to us.
You're on the street corner, maybe talking to your peers. And all of a sudden, an unmarked car pulls up and cops jump out and pull guns on you and shake you down on the corner. And obviously, if you got anything on you, then you're locked up, that type of stuff. They call jump outs. Well, the police here claimed, we had a meeting with them a while back, claimed, well, we don't do jump outs, and da 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 da, and they kept trying to explain that. And so finally, we had to say to them, said, look, I don't care what you call it. You've got cops in an unmarked car jumping out on kids and shaking them down instantly and locking them up. I said, you can call that Mickey Mouse, I don't care, but you need to stop it. And that has been a bone of contention, because they deny that it's happening all the time. And of course, we see it all the time. Those are the types of things that folks deal with on a daily basis.
We're speaking today with Pastor Graylin Hagler, Washington, D.C. Activist and advocate for racial justice and Palestinian rights. I'd encourage those of you who are on the interview via Zoom, if you have questions for our guests, please submit them through the chat function at the bottom of the page. I'm monitoring that and be happy to pass them along to our guests. Graylin, let me ask you about a brother, a UCC clergyman. Otis Moss III from Chicago has come out recently with a couple of films, one of which he named after James Cone's book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, a requiem for Ahmaud Arbery. And then his next one was a sermon where he talked about the hymn, the great charge in the African-American community, We Shall Overcome. In The Cross and the Lynching Tree, he referred to the COVID, not 19 virus, but the COVID-1619 virus. And in the second sermon, when he was talking about we shall overcome someday, he asked the question, when will be the someday that we shall overcome? Do you have a response to either one of these from your brother UCC pastor, Otis Moss III?
Well, I've heard about it. I have not seen them yet. Those pieces. But one of the things I immediately respond this way, I do on part of the time I take off or try to take off from the church, I do what's called a walk. For me, I call it a walkabout. and a walkabout is I go to some place that pulls at my soul in a particular way. And this past year, my walkabout took me down to Point Comfort, Virginia. And Point Comfort is where that ship arrived in 1619. It later became a fort, Fort Monroe there. But that was one of the places where my spirit took me to just stand on that ground. And then I went over to Southampton County, Virginia. And y'all familiar with what happened in Southampton County, Virginia? That was the Nat Turner uprising. Nat Turner was a plantation preacher. And basically it was because of partly his vision, his revelation that led him to not only organize people into a rebellion, but to lead that rebellion that closed down the entire southern lands for a while because everybody was afraid that there was going to be more and more slave rebellions that were going to take place. So that's a part of my sort of my own personal experience of walking those sacred grounds. And also realizing this is that, and this is kind of a struggle I think for all of us, is we always want to talk about nonviolence, but how do you remain nonviolent in a violent context? How do you remain nonviolent when no one seems to care? How do you remain nonviolent in that kind of setting? Because it requires a kind of revolutionary spirit at times. You know, so everybody was calling me up when young folks were out there looting stuff and wanting me to come out and condemn it. I said, I will not. I will not condemn it. And the reason I won't condemn it is simply because when people are angry and people are outraged and nobody seems to have been listening and we've been marching for decades, hundreds of years in one form or fashion, struggling in one way or another, and still we're in the same place, then that's the frustration that young folks feel, and they are responding. When we're talking about two separate churches, you know, one was in Nazi Germany, you had Hitler that purged the seminaries and purged the universities of people and voices that were not sympathetic to Nazism. That's why we ended up in that period of a whole lot of German theologians in American seminaries, because they were fleeing Germany and coming into places like Union and places like that. But there was the Confessing Church of Germany, the Confessing Church of Germany that decided that enough was enough, and they set a bomb under Hitler's conference table. Did not succeed, but it was that Confessing Church of Germany. Dietrich Bonhoeffer dies on the last days of the war. Or I can point out another preacher, John Brown, right, who leads the rebellion into Harper's Ferry, but also out in Lawrence, Kansas, who had brought with him a lot of the seminary-trained black folks out of Oberlin Seminary, Oberlin Theological School at that point, who went and walked with him and fought with him and died with him. But, you know, these were the kinds of struggle. So we got to raise the question sometimes. Maybe we're being too superficial in our approach to things. And I'm not advocating violence or bombing or shooting, but I'm pointing out issues in history that changed the course of history. Because the Civil War really started with John Brown. John Brown fired those first shots of that Civil War.